And good morning, everyone. This is the Court of Appeals for December 9, and I'll have the marshal introduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Jessen, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning once again. This is the first of two oral arguments that we have today, and we then have four non-oral matters that we will be subsequently considering. This first matter is file A-20-0692, Ellen Callahar Grissom, appellant versus Marvin W. Strohschein et al. As the respondents. And for counsel's benefit, you'll see that we do have the clock in the corner, and hopefully you all can see it. And per our usual rules, there'll be 15 minutes for appellant's argument, 15 minutes for respondent, 5 minutes for appellant to for rebuttal if you choose. If at any time during our oral arguments we lose, for technology reasons, hearing you, especially, the marshal is instructed to stop the clock, and we'll try to get the technology resurrected before we restart it. Also, you'll note that as judges, we will mute ourselves when we're not talking, and we ask you to do the same thing. That seems to continue to help our technology. We are recording the proceeding per our usual judicial branch policy, and so any other recording in any method is prohibited. And so what I ask counsel to do when you begin your argument is to state your full name for our record, and then you may begin. And so we'll start with counsel for appellant. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I am Rory Mattson here on behalf of appellant. Before this court is a matter that has already been presented, albeit in a different fashion. When this matter was before this court the first time, the court established that appellant's mother, Ruth Strohschein, has an express roadway easement over the existing, well, the easement area that is now in dispute. That is the law of the case that was established the last time this matter was before this court. This court also established that appellant does not have an express roadway easement based on the language of the quitclaim deed, but remanded for consideration of an implied easement. On remand, appellant established the necessary elements of an implied easement. As the court is likely aware, the severance of title is not at issue, but what was disputed by respondents was the element of use and the element of necessity. And I'll start with talking about use and then lead into necessity. On remand, appellant presented admissible evidence to establish the use element through sworn interrogatories, documents that were recorded in the Morrison County.
Mr. Mattson, before you get too far in, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I did have a preliminary question about the elements that we apply in this case. It seems like there's no dispute in the briefing of the party of what those elements are. You were about to go into the two contested ones now, but perhaps I just need a little bit of help and understanding, and that is, I noticed from the Olson case onward that there seems to be some language that suggests they're not what we would describe as our traditional elements, meaning that all three need to be met. Olson references necessity at the time of severance is required, and the subsequent case law uses that same language, but that the other elements are guides for the court to determine whether an implied easement exists. Now, normally, elements mean you need all three. What my question for you is, if indeed they're not what we would call our traditional elements, other than necessity, if we were to conclude, for example, that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to necessity, would it necessarily preclude summary judgment for either party? In other words, the court was proper in denying it for your client, but perhaps improper with regard to respondent if they are mere guides as opposed to elements that would require factual presentation at trial. So really, it's a standard question. You can see how I've evolved it a little bit, but could you answer that for me in terms of the standard and the elements?
Thank you, Your Honor. I can try. My reading and understanding of the case law is similar to what you were describing, in that necessity is truly the only element, as we generally understand elements, as in that is required to some extent in order to, well, it is required to prove that this is, to prove an implied easement, it is necessary for it to be necessary. So necessity, I would agree, is the only sort of true element that needs to be established in order to have an implied easement. If it's not a necessary easement, then it doesn't, you know, it doesn't meet this the element to be required and to be established. The remaining considerations, use and severance of title, use really predominantly is a factor, and that is something that is not, it is more of a sliding scale, I would say. I would describe it as that, in the sense that it's not as readily apparent whether use versus with necessity, it's pretty clear. It's either this is necessary or this isn't, with a little bit of gray area. With use, if you've already established necessity, use is a factor to consider, but without, I guess, checking all the boxes of the use factor, the implied easement, the one requesting the implied easement, is not precluded based on that alone. I hope that helps answer your question. If it doesn't,
it does. Thank you. I just, the flip side, though, I assume the absence, whether we use the word factor or element, on the other hand, would make, nevertheless, summary judgment appropriate. Would you agree with that? Certainly. And we're all agreeing by your statement with regard to necessity, but as to use, for instance, the absence of use, even alleged, still might make a case appropriate for summary judgment as the court ordered here.
I would argue that the complete absence of use, if there's no indication whatsoever that the trail A, as it's now described, if there is no evidence whatsoever that that was ever used, or any indication that it was ever used, then it would be an appropriate determination that by only satisfying necessity, this specific area would not be the right, would not be an appropriate, well, it would not be established that that is the area for the implied easement. But nevertheless, by establishing necessity, that does demonstrate that there should be an implied easement or a method for accessing the property when it was severed. So that's where the severance comes in. I would argue that with the severance consideration and the necessity element, then the landowner, who would presumably be landlocked, is entitled to access their property. So by failing to establish use, an implied easement itself is not precluded, but it would be an issue for the fact finder to determine where that easement is appropriately positioned on the property. That's, I think, the appropriate lens to consider the use element. And here, there was admissible evidence. There was substantial evidence that was submitted to the district court that was simply not considered. And I think partly that could have been a misinterpretation of what the evidence was intended to demonstrate. And that is, for example, Judge Anderson's recollections. His affidavit is not provided to establish Ruth's intent, but his affidavit does provide personal recollections, his own personal recollections of the property, of the easement area, of the family's use of the easement area. And with that personal knowledge, he was able to support the use element, and that has not been satisfactorily rebutted to any degree. Respondents have provided third party affidavits that have really no evidentiary value because they have no dates on them, that we have no idea what they were observing or when. And even if there was, taking all of their observations is true, we still don't know anything about what happened at the time of severance. Whereas
Mr. Mattson, can I just follow up on your point about Judge Anderson's affidavit? Can you point us to the language that you think reflects that he had personal knowledge of the use of an existing roadway as an easement, as opposed to his knowledge that the mother told him that it was used as an easement?
Because
I'm not entirely clear on what language you're referring to.
Sure. So if I'm looking at page 12 of appellant's brief, and the paragraphs that are cited there, the bold and highlighted or bold and italicized text were from Judge Anderson's recollections that her family had always used the existing road to do so in the past. It doesn't state that Ruth told Judge Anderson that was the case, but it states that her family did this. And it also states on the next one, the same statement and same support from his own personal recollections that is not couched in hearsay from Ruth. Again, it's just a statement that this is how Ruth and her family had always accessed Ellen's parcel. And based on those statements and his additional reflections from that time, speak to establish his personal recollections. And even if it is hearsay, it's still at least admissible to the extent that it demonstrates the conversation. It doesn't go to prove the truth of the matter being asserted, but it serves to add to the support of the use of the existing roadway. And what I think is also particularly relevant, and it cannot be disputed, is the language that was recorded in that deed specifically describes the easement area as an existing roadway, defines its location by the existing roadway, and also sets forth its scope or its purpose for ingress and egress. That reflection in the recorded document was sufficient to establish an express easement for Ruth. In its own right, that demonstrates that at that time, the language, an existing roadway, was being used for that purpose, and it was intended to be continued to use for that purpose.
Mr. Mattson, go ahead and finish your sentence, and I'll ask my question then. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, thank you. I was simply going to say that in itself, the language of the deed serves to demonstrate the use at the time of severance and the intention to continue that use going forward.
So coming back to the necessity question, isn't the key issue for us really the interpretations of these ordinances? I mean, the district court put really the focus on the fact of the 94 township resolution. So from my perspective, and tell me if you agree or disagree with this, you know, the major question for us in necessity is, look, is the 94 township resolution definitive, meaning, or is it open to interpretation? And then we look at the 85, you know, township ordinance, which seems to say the road would be vacated, and we say there's a disputed fact.
So it's unclear why the district court did not even consider or mention the 1985 vacation order, road vacation order. But there is no dispute of fact, and there's nothing reasonably to dispute about what the impact of that order had, and that is it vacated an entire portion of the road so that it no longer went to appellant's property. So 230th Street still exists, but because of the 1985 vacation order, it no longer extends to appellant's property.
But couldn't you read those orders? I mean, to say, you know, the 85 says, well, it's we're going to, or they're to be vacated, and then look at what the 94 resolution and say, but maybe that didn't happen.
I guess I had not to interpret it that way, because the vacation order conclusively states that footage that's described there, which is equals a half section, is vacated. So there does not seem to be any dispute of the impact of the 1985 vacation order. The subsequent 1994 township resolution acknowledged 230th Street, but it had no impact on the portion of 230th Street's, the portion that was vacated. It simply, that was no longer part of the road. So it's appropriate to still describe 230th Street, but that street no longer extended to appellant's property. So that is the key distinction that I think is may have been lost at district court.
So, Mr. Mattson, just following up on that point then, can you clarify how, or explain how the record makes it clear that the attachment A to the 94 resolution, the reference to 230th Street doesn't include the portion that was vacated?
Well, it's in its own right, there would be no reason to include a portion that didn't exist as far as that road is concerned at that time. If the portion of the road is vacated, but the road still exists, identifying it as it was in the exhibit to the resolution would be perfectly understandable, and there wouldn't be any reason to, I guess, expand on the history of the road and its, a portion of it no longer existing. I see my time is up, and I...
And Mr. Mattson, do you believe you have finished your answer to Judge Cochran's question?
I hope so. I'd be happy to expand on it if not, or address it in rebuttal.
Certainly, you'll have the 5-minute rebuttal too if you wish to expand on it. Very well, thank you. And counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jonathan D. Wolf. I am counsel for respondents in this appeal. Now, I wanted to start out by addressing something from appellant's reply brief, because we haven't had the chance to respond to that yet before we get into the questions, hopefully, because it is highly relevant, but it's also maybe a little bit of a personal grievance of mine here. On page 9 of their brief, the reply brief, they say respondent argues for the first time on appeal that the necessity element is also unmet because appellant could simply petition the township for cartway access to her property. This argument is improperly raised at this late stage and therefore should not be considered. Late stage, I have been shouting for 2 years that what you need to do if you are landlocked is file a cartway petition. And not only have I been saying it for 2 years, I said it four times on the record at the hearing on the order that's being appealed from. I said it at the top of page 9, at the bottom of page 9. I said it again on page 11. I said it again on page 14. What you do if you are landlocked is you petition for a cartway. That is the proper.
Can I just clarify? I did have a question regarding the relevance of that, because they haven't petitioned for a cartway, nor have they requested that in this proceeding. Are you indicating that there's law that precludes one, even if all three elements of implied easement are met, that they cannot get it unless they've applied for a cartway?
No, Judge, I'm not saying that. If all three elements are met, they can get an implied easement, but all three elements are not met here. And counsel seemed to be under the misimpression at the district court level. And you can read some of the quotes in the transcript there too, that all you need to prove is that you're landlocked to get an implied easement, which is not the case. And I'll actually circle back to your question earlier about whether all three of these are actual elements. I refer you to the Lake George Park case, which comes nearly 50 years after Olson. That refers to these as elements. It says the elements of an implied easement are 1, separation of title. We all agree that title was separated, but clearly title has to have been separated for there to be an implied easement. 2, the use which gives rise to the easement shall have been so long continued and apparent as to show that it was intended to be permanent. Well, that, of course, you know, we know can't be met for a number of reasons that we've discussed at length in the brief. I mean, namely, there were fences over it in 1993. My clients put in gates in response to the first summary judgment order by the district court, which was, it was either 2018 or 2019 because it was impassable. It had been impassable because of those fences, many of which were put in by the parties, in this case, his father. Why would our clients have to put in gates to allow access if that land was accessible? And the third element is that the easement is necessary to the beneficial enjoyment of the land granted, which of course we've been talking about. But the case law since Olson does refer to these as elements, and all three need to be met in order for there to be an implied easement. Now, necessity is related to being landlocked, but it's not the same thing. And if that is the only one that is met, there's not going to be an implied easement there. There may be, and there should be, a right to petition for a cartway. I know, you know, up here in St. Cloud, that comes up quite often where parcels are landlocked. I don't imagine that comes up in Minneapolis very often, that there is a landlocked parcel, but I've done a number of the cartway petitions. I don't know why this wasn't a cartway petition. I've brought that up repeatedly, but I know that wasn't what was brought here, but I wanted to clear that up. We certainly have been pointing that out repeatedly. So,
Mr. Wolf, can I just bring you back to the Lake George case? Notice in that case also, it doesn't appear that they've changed any law in reciting the same cases, and also refers to Olson once again that while an easement will not be implied unless it is necessary, all three elements are used as an indicia of the party's intent. I guess the broader question I did ask Mr. Mattson is, it seemed when you read all these cases together, it is simply not our traditional, appears not to be our traditional elements scenario. And the main reason I bring that question up is that it strikes me that absent, if or with the presence of necessity, it would seem hard pressed for anybody to win a summary judgment given the case law, which is, Mr. Mattson used the phrase factors, which I can understand why when you read those cases, it suggests you need the one, but not necessarily the other, but all three are indicia and they're not exclusive of other factors. So that's my question is here, it appears from the affidavits, you got your traditional, it was used, no, it wasn't used. You got affidavits on both sides. That strikes me as a traditional fact question and such that the court was proper in denying appellant's summary judgment, but perhaps also improper in granting your client's summary judgment. Can you correct me if I'm wrong, either in my understanding of the test or the facts in this case?
Well, Your Honor, let me try to answer that as best I can. An implied easement, like you said, is just what it is called. It is implied. It has to be inferred, from the facts. But if you look at the undisputed facts, and if you actually look at the affidavits carefully, and you look at the maps are key to this, because to have an implied easement over a specific area, a specific path on three-dimensional physical land, you have to have been crossing for ingress and egress at that specific area. None of their affidavits say that. Ours do. Ours say it wasn't there. It couldn't have been there. You crossed our land with permission at other areas. It couldn't have been there because there were fences over it. They could have come back with an affidavit from appellant herself saying, yes, I did. In 1993, I crossed there. There weren't fences there. Maybe that's a fact issue. They didn't because they couldn't. They have these vague interrogatory responses that said, oh, yes, I crossed the land, me, appellant, Ellen. That doesn't say where in an interrogatory response. They have an affidavit from Judge Anderson. I know Judge Anderson. He's a good guy. I'm sure he recalls what happened 30 years ago in his office as well as anyone would. But he wasn't out there. Now, look at that language that you looked at when counsel was speaking before. He doesn't say, oh, yeah, I went out there. I was a family friend. I was out there for picnics crossing the land. He's an attorney drafting deeds in a law office. We all know as attorneys and judges who were attorneys that you're not the one out there crossing land. Any information you get in drafting deeds, you're getting from the clients. So they do not have any facts in the record that say, yeah, we were crossing, this is a fact issue, that say that the necessity issue is even there when you look at that 1994 township order. You know, I'll also note that I'm sorry, I'm using some first names here because there are a lot of similar last names here since this is a family issue. This Ben who submitted an affidavit who also doesn't say specifically what he needs to say was 11 years old at the time of severance. So I think that's suspect too.
In determining whether to grant summary judgment, the court is required to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, as you know. And while, appellant's answers to the interrogatories maybe aren't as precise as you argue they should be, why are they not sufficient to create a disputed issue of fact as to use where one of the answers says that plaintiff has used the entire portion of the easement, as have other family members, most notably during the deer hunting season. So it goes on to discuss other uses, but it does refer to the easement. And then in another interrogatory answer, she states that her use was prior to ownership and was from childhood. Taking that as a whole, why isn't that enough to create a fact dispute that she alleges use of the easement and your clients allege that the easement wasn't used because of the fences and the swampland?
Sure. Your Honor, number one, there's case law to the effect of if there is some metaphysical factual dispute, that's not enough to defeat summary judgment. So I think that's important to recognize. But maybe more importantly, look at what she's actually stating it was used for. This is a claimed ingress egress easement, which means accessing the land, getting there, getting back. It's not for hunting. It's not for hay rides. It's not for berry picking. It has to be for ingress and egress. This is how you are accessing your parcel on a day-to-day basis, you know, with vehicles. So the use is one reason that does not create a factual dispute. The other reason is it's not specific as to, she says easement, but this is before we defined on land where the easement is. If you look at the district court's order, the district court found that very compelling, and especially the district court found compelling the fact that the first time around in summary judgment, appellant misstated where the fences were and when the fences has put in to gain an apparent factual advantage, which is the same thing her interrogatory responses are doing. You can say, I used the easement without defining it. If you can defeat summary judgment by doing that without saying where this purported easement is, where you were actually crossing the land, I mean, this kind of loses all meaning. The other thing I will note is we brought a cross motion for summary judgment, but we were disinclined to bring a summary judgment motion. Appellant brought one, and we said, well, as long as she's bringing one, I guess we will bring our own. And that's what you can see in the stipulation that we reached, so that there are only three briefs in the district court instead of six. If she thought there was no factual dispute, we said, well, you know, I guess we can go with that. But she was the one who first said there was no factual dispute. This is ripe for summary judgment. So I think that bears taking into account as well.
Mr. Wolf, could you assist me in understanding the law of the case as it relates to the explicit easement and benefit of a mother? You seem to suggest in your briefing that it's absolutely irrelevant, and yet it is what we do know as a law of the case that an easement was granted to her precisely along the A line and for purposes of access to the property. So how, on what basis would we ignore that? And I'm purposely not getting into the issue of potential hearsay of the judge's statement, but just the fact of an explicit easement that happens to be along the line as alleged for an implied easement by the appellant in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that I'd necessarily say you ignore that. I just don't think what a party who is not a party to this case has as far as an easement is relevant as to whether appellant has an implied easement. And it also strikes me as very odd to say, okay, grantor, mother, reserved an express easement for herself, and yet it was also the intent of her at the time of severance that an implied easement was also supposed to be there for her daughter.
Maybe my question, I didn't understand the appellants to be claiming that, but simply the existence of the express easement when you consider that for implied easement, inferences are to be drawn. It just happened. I understand it's not in dispute. Am I correct that easement is the letter A pathway in the map? And so that is as a matter of the case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
So my understanding of the law of the case is that there's an express easement along pathway A, which happens to be the alleged, perhaps one of two pathways alleged, but the alleged implied easement by appellant.
I think that's correct. If you look at the legal descriptions, that's where that personal easement to mother is reserved. Yeah, I think that's correct. I guess maybe I'm not totally understanding the question as to
wouldn't we look at that as part of the whether there are genuine issues of material fact as to whether use along that same path as alleged factor at least has been met for purposes of summary judgment such that there should be a trial?
I don't know why you would, I guess, because for an implied easement, the grantor's express intent, what she wrote down, is not necessarily relevant, but the implied intent is. And how you determine that intent was implied is by these elements we were talking about, separation of title, use that is shall have been so long and continuous and apparent, that the easement is necessary to the beneficial enjoyment of the land. That's how you determine the implied intent. Now, if Ruth reserved a personal easement for herself, why would she also not expressly just say, and also this goes to Ellen, if that was her intent at the time? Why do we have to imply anything if she went to the trouble of reserving herself a personal easement to herself at the time of severance? I view that as a negative for the existence of an additional implied easement, the fact that she went to the trouble at the time of severance of reserving herself an express easement. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Well, I see that I'm running short of time here. So unless there are any other questions, I suppose I will wrap up and thank you for your time.
I believe Judge Cochran, you go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Thank you, Judge Sleater. Sorry, I had my mute off, on and off. Anyway, I'm having trouble with the mute button, but I've got it figured out. So I did want to just turn back to the necessity question and ask you a question similar to the question that Judge Jessen asked Mr. Mattson. And so my question for you is, why isn't there a genuine issue of material fact as to necessity, given the seeming inconsistency between the 1985 vacation order and the 1994 resolution, or aren't those documents inconsistent?
I don't think they are inconsistent, Your Honor, and I'll tell you a couple of reasons. One, I don't think we should even be considering the 1985 order because that was not disclosed in discovery. The very first time anyone in this case saw that was in a reply submission to the summary judgment motion. But two, more importantly, that document is not relevant. We have the 1994 order, which came out early in 1994 and said these roads have been duly established by use and or prescription for quite some time. And if you look at the legal descriptions in that order, it says 230th Street extends across the entire top of the section. I believe it's section 11. I don't have a legal description right in front of me. But if you look at something that comes out in 1994, nearly contemporaneously with the time of severance, and then you look at something in 1985 that doesn't necessarily even say we are vacating these roads, there's no inconsistency in ruling that. Oh, I'm sorry.
Could I just, Judge Sleater, would you mind if I ask a kind of follow-up
question? No, I think that'd be appropriate. Thank you.
Well, even if we ignored the 85 one and just looked at the 94 resolution, isn't there language in there that says that nearly all the township roads were already established? So does that really, definitively resolve the necessity?
Your Honor, I think that nearly all means nearly all have been officially recorded. The purpose of that 1994 order was to officially codify roads township roads that were not in writing somewhere. The roads were physically out there in reality. And the purpose of that order was to say, in paper, yes, these roads exist. We're establishing their center lines, the legal descriptions of those center lines. So I think that that language of most, I think most being established means most have been officially established is my reading of that. And of course, you know, I'll note too, it is a 1994 order. The time of severance was technically in 93. I mean, you go to war with the army you have, you know, not the army you want. We would have loved it if it had been, you know, 6 months before rather than 6 months after. But as I described in the briefs, there's plenty of time between 1985 and 1993 and 1994 to reestablish 230th Street across the whole top of that section, even if it had been, extinguished.
Is there any evidence to that effect?
There isn't, as you probably saw, other than that it existed in 94, which I guess is pretty compelling evidence, and that it takes time to establish a township road. As you probably saw in the district court record, and as we learned, being as how we didn't get the 1994 one until late in discovery, and we got the 85 one as a response to a reply submission, the township records are a bit spotty in this case. So do I have any township records saying, yeah, we reestablished it? No, but there wouldn't be if it was reestablished by use, which takes 6 years. So, you know, I don't have any other records, but we can infer by the fact that the road existed, 230th Street in 1994, that it was around at some point before that, which is, I think, the best evidence we have of it.
Now, Mr. Wolf, can I just one more follow up of all these questions we've added at the end here regarding the 1985 vacation order? My review of the transcript of the summary judgment motion is you did also mention it was late, but you did not object and the court did not rule that it was not considered. So is it proper to say that it is part of the record?
That it's part of the record, that 1985
vacation order.
Vacation order. I think it's proper to say, you know, I was the attorney there. I was the one who, as I'm sure Red said that. I guess I object to it now. I don't know. I went to that summary judgment hearing knowing that we had moved for it. They had, with a little bit of an attitude of, if we're going to resolve this in summary judgment, you know, maybe there's some fair play on each side. And you know, I didn't object then, and I guess take that for what it's worth. I certainly don't think, though, if that's part of the record, that it's worth much as part of the record.
Okay, very well. Thank you, Mr. Wolf and Mr. Mattson. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start kind of where counsel started regarding the town or Cartway petition. First, the argument that we were identifying as being first made on appeal is that the petitioner for a Cartway must go through, or the fact that the argument that you can petition for a Cartway precludes necessity. So that was the point that was trying to be made at paragraph 9. I do not dispute that Mr. Wolf has raised the Cartway petition on several occasions. We did not ever interpret that or see it as a argument to undermine necessity. It exists. There's no dispute that one can petition for a Cartway. To do so, however, the petitioner must ultimately pay damages to the landowner where the Cartway may be made. It operates much like a condemnation order where land is taken by the government and the government has to pay a reasonable value for the taking. It's the same effect in this private interaction. So to sit and claim that this is a viable option and should be pursued ignores that if appellant has an implied easement, why would she go and pay for a Cartway and pay damages for the landowner when she already has an implied easement over that, over land that exists? So that's where the argument is supposed to address, at least that we made in our reply. And then as far as the use, the evidence relied on by respondents is contradictory. There is an affidavit from one of the respondents that acknowledges they use this trail for fixing their fences and often walk on it. There's a similar statement in the record from respondent's prior attorney acknowledging that appellants have been using the easement. And these demonstrate that, well, now all of a sudden to claim that they never actually used Trail A and instead used Trail B this entire time is not supported by their own record.
Mr. Madsen, can I, it sort of evolves from what you just raised, but another standard question from this case law, starting with Olson, and I believe it's copied throughout all the cases, that evidence after severance can neither create an easement, nor can it end one that preexisted. So I'm assuming from that, and since we're dealing with inferences, is it safe to say that evidence after that is perhaps admissible and relevant, but less important than the evidence prior, in our case, to 1993, as to whether an easement existed?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor, that the relevant time frame is at the time of severance, the use at the time of severance, the necessity at the time of severance, change in circumstance does not defeat or create an easement after that time period. So that also goes to the effect of the fence argument that respondent relies on. Fences were there, who knows when exactly, but if any fence was there at the time of severance, that fence existed when Ruth created an express easement for herself, ultimately, and claiming that easement doesn't exist because of a fence at that time just is not relevant, and it does not go to prove the point that respondent wants it to. And to that same point, the express easement that was granted, I don't think it can be, it's open for debate clearly, but the intent of Ruth at that time was to create an express easement for everyone, for her, for Ellen, who was going to be the landowner of the property that would be accessed by that easement, and to now claim that she had no intent or desire to do so based on the court's prior ruling, I think ignores the circumstances that were really not reasonably disputed based on the evidence that we've already discussed. And as far as the public record, the 1985 vacation order, the timeliness is clearly in dispute, and I don't claim that it was produced before the reply and summary judgment, but it's public record. It was on file at the Morrison County Land Records Office since 1985, and it's admissible regardless of whether it was produced in discovery. Respondent had every opportunity to go search the land records themselves and chose not to do so. And ultimately, the prejudice of not considering that to appellant is far greater than not considering it and the harm that would result to respondents in that instance. So for those reasons, we submit on behalf of appellant that the district court erred in its grant of summary judgment in favor of respondents and denial of summary judgment in favor of appellants, and would ask that this court overturn that decision and at the very least remand for a determination on the use and necessity if needed. But we are here today arguing that that is not necessary because of the facts that exist in the record.
Very good. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate the answers to your questions, of which we had many, as you could tell, and a good refresher on real estate law that we have with your case. We appreciate both the briefing and your comments as well. So we will take the matter under advisement. We'll be issuing an order in the statutory time frame.